We have been working 16 weeks now to get down to the place where we're talking about putting the Bible into English. And that's, of course, what matters to each one of us. In the days before printing, we've already talked about this, John Wycliffe translated into almost recognizable English for us in the year 1382. But this was in the days before printing. So, of course, it was every copy had to be handmade. And, of course, it was very expensive. As you know, as you remember in our discussion, he was condemned as a heretic. His writings were condemned, and after he died of natural causes, his bones were dug up, burned, and thrown into the river. So, guess what happened? 140 years went by before anyone tried it again. So, I don't know what all the reasons were, but it was quite a long time, and the man who did it next was, of course, William Tyndale. Politics, however, played a large part in the Reformation in England. Henry VIII, who lived from 1491 to 1547, was always a staunch defender of the Catholic faith. He resisted Reformed theology to the day of his death. And we need to understand what all is going on here, because this is obviously, you know, you've heard these stories, you've probably seen movies about it, but we need to understand the conflicting sides of the issue here. But his desire to divorce Catherine of Aragon in order to produce a male heir, which he didn't think she would ever do, to succeed him, led to a break with Rome in 1533. Now, we're going to come back and we're going to discover that Tyndale's New Testament, he was working on it from 1522 on. It was first printed in 1525, so it had already been out 8 years before this break with Rome took place. As a result of this and other conflicts with Rome, he dissolved the English monasteries in 1536 and again in 1539, and in effect broke the backbone of the Catholic Church in England. Thomas Cranmer, another famous British politician, or I shouldn't say politician, I guess technically, he was the Archbishop of Canterbury and lived from 1489 to 1556, believed in the Reform movement and assisted Henry VIII in his break from Rome. So whenever, and you remember the story here, whenever Henry VIII had some problem, why, he could go to Cranmer who would say, yeah, let's move away from Rome. And of course, Thomas More was trying to get him to go back toward Rome. And so poor Henry was torn back and forth. And of course, he pretty much did what he wanted to do anyway, but I'm just trying to create in your mind a picture of what all was going on here. After Henry VIII died, his son Edward VI was regent for a period of only 6 years. But he was guided during that period by the Protestant Archbishop Cranmer. And so during that six-year period, what happened? Things were pushed toward Protestantism. Well, but in 1553, Mary Tudor, otherwise nicknamed as Bloody Mary, took control after the untimely death of Edward VI. She was the daughter of Catherine and Henry VIII and was determined to return Catholicism to England. Mary ruled for only 5 years. In 1558, Elizabeth I became the new Queen of England, and her leanings were toward Protestantism. She ruled England from 1558 to 1603 and decisively determined that England would be a Protestant nation. And during all this, now if you keep those political dates in mind more or less, we're going to talk about the story of William Tyndale. William Tyndale was born in 1484, just about 100 years after John Wycliffe had died. He came from Gloucestershire, near the border of Wales. From very early in his youth, he was a student at the University of Oxford and was, quote, singularly addicted to the study of scriptures. I mean, this is a man that he just loved to study the Bible. There's no other way to put it. At Oxford, he studied in Magdalen Hall under classical teachers such as Grocyn, Latimer, and Lineker. After about 1510, 10, he decided he should move from Oxford to Cambridge. There he studied with Erasmus. And why was Erasmus important? Putting the pieces together, Erasmus was the one, the first one, to print a Greek New Testament. He grabbed whatever he could find, put it together, even translated pieces of the Latin back into Greek because he couldn't find some parts of the Greek, and printed a Latin Bible. And he printed that Latin Bible while Tyndale was with him there at Cambridge, about 1516. And Tyndale was there from approximately 1510 to 1520. So, after approximately 10 years at Cambridge, Tyndale went back to his native countryside and served as a private tutor for Sir John Walsh. During those times, and it was only a couple of years, away from the public and university setting, Tyndale had opportunity to interact with some unthinking churchmen, and there were a lot of them around. On one occasion, he was reported as saying, if God, and I should have put all the classical spelling in here, it makes it more colorful, but these are his words, if God spare my life, ere many years, I will cause a boy that driveth with a plow shall know more the scripture than thou dost. And this is a very famous statement from Tyndale. He said, you guys who claim to be standing up and preaching and teaching people about the Bible are so ignorant about the Bible, what it really teaches and what it really means, that the kid out there that's just hardly a teenager, you know, bumping along behind the plow, he's going to know more about the Bible than you do. And that was ended up being his lifetime goal. It was during Tyndale's time at Cambridge, I've already mentioned this, working with Erasmus, that Erasmus produced his first Greek New Testament in 1516. And of course, there were numerous other editions of the Greek New Testament after his first. Yes, Joanne? Hold on. Yeah, it's okay.
Maybe I'm getting ahead of the story. How did Tyndale want to do this? Did he want to do it by making the Bible more available? Did he want to do it by being a teacher? Did he want to do it by being an evangelist? Did he have any method in mind when he made this statement?
You will see. Just,
okay, yeah, I'm ahead of the story.
You're getting a little ahead of the story. Okay. You'll see as we proceed here. After a couple years in the countryside, Tyndale decided to go to London. He sought out Tunstall, the Bishop of London, but Tunstall would not even talk to him. But Tyndale found a friend in Monmouth who took him in and stated that, notice, and I put in some of these statements because they give us real interesting insights into what kind of a person Tyndale was. Monmouth said about him, I took him into my house half a year, and there he lived like a good priest as me thought. And you recognize the old English. He studied most part of the day and of the night at his book. And he would eat but sodden meat, and this would not, he's not talking just about flesh, he's talking about meat in those days, remember, meant food. He would eat but sodden food by his goodwill, nor drink but a small single beer. Thought that was interesting. I never saw him wear linen about him in the space he was with me. I did promise him £10 sterling to pray for my father and mother, their souls, and all Christian souls. I did pay it him when he made his exchange to Hamburg. And we're going to see why that was really important here in a little bit. Later, when Tyndale was accused, Monmouth was imprisoned in the Tower of London for the help he had given to Tyndale. So Monmouth was one of the church people from London. He wasn't a high official, but he was in the church business. And when Tyndale approached him, he said, yeah, come stay with me. And he ended up recognizing that Tyndale was a saint of kinds and of sorts, and so he really assisted him. Tyndale learned a great deal while in London, but he later stated, quote, I understood at the last not only that there was no room in my Lord of London's palace to translate the New Testament, but also that there was no place to do it in all of England. So at least one thing he discovered here before he got his head chopped off, he discovered that, if you were going to translate the Bible into English, you couldn't do it in London. You couldn't do it in England. So Tyndall said, okay, I've got a job to do. I'll find someplace else to do it. So he left England and traveled to the free city of Hamburg in 1524. Most of the following year he spent in Wittenberg studying under Luther. So we know that a number of the translations that he favored for his English Bible were influenced by Luther's German, and now you begin to understand why. In 1525, he returned to Hamburg, where he received money from his friend Monmouth. What did he do with the money? Well, in April of that year, he went to Cologne to see if he could begin printing his New Testament. There he found an expert printer who began doing the work. But there were many enemies of the Reformation, and they discovered what Tyndale was doing. Just unfortunately by accident, now I shouldn't say unfortunately by accident, I suspect the devil directly had his hand in it. One of the greatest enemies of the Reformation happened to come into the same printer's office to get some printing done for him. And he happened to overhear some of the printers say a little bit about printing some Bible stuff for England. And of course, immediately his ears perked up, and what did he do? Although the work was supposed to be completely secret, the Anti-Reformation group took the printers out one evening to drink beer and got them drunk until they talked about what they were doing for England. So there was nothing for Tyndale to do but get out of there. Tyndale's enemies then informed the city leaders of what was taking place, and Tyndale's work was stopped. Tyndale and an assistant by the name of Roy grabbed what they could and escaped by boat up the River Rhine to Worms. There, Tyndale found another printer by the name of Schoeffer. Cochlaeus, and he was the one who was particularly pursuing Luther, the Anti-Reformation leader who was trying to stop Luther's work, informed the people in England about what Tyndale was doing. He says, get prepared, keep your eyes open, because Bibles are coming in the English language. So Tyndale changed the format completely and printed his New Testament in a new format with no introduction and no notes in the margin. Now, I don't know, I only read this information. I don't know exactly what's implied by this. So I don't know if you can help me. Some of you might understand some of these printing terms better than I do. But he had printed it originally. His original intention was to print it in a little bit larger format and with a lot of notes in the margins. And, of course, you can imagine these notes were very inflammatory about the Catholic Church and about the Pope and all that kind of stuff. And so that was his original plan, and he had it all worked out. He had done the translation work, he had done all that, but, hey, he'd been stopped. So he decided, print it in a different format, a different size, and a different look, and maybe people won't recognize it when it shows up in England. So he printed a completely different format, he left out his notes, etc., and 3,000 copies were initially made. Then he returned to his original plan, which he had begun in Cologne, and printed his New Testament with many notes. Both of these editions were shipped into England secretly, hidden inside of other merchandise. So you can see what's going on here. Tyndale's life is being threatened. He's translating and printing. How is he getting the stuff into England? He's stuffing it into other merchandise. He happens to be friends with a number of merchants who are doing business back and forth across the channel. So when they ship a load of this or that or the other, probably clothing or something, he makes arrangements for somebody at the other end to know, okay, box load of X is coming, and in that box load of X will be a whole bunch of Bibles. And so that's how they got them into England. On December 2, 1525, Edward Lee, who later in 1531 became Archbishop of York, so you can see he was also high up in the church, and who was visiting the continent, quote unquote, in 1525, wrote to Henry VIII that, quote, an Englishman, at the solicitation and insistence of Luther, with whom he is, have translated the New Testament into English, and within 4 days intendeth to return with the same imprinted into England. Now, yes, go ahead.
A comment on communication. I think communication is really vital to God's work, and the truth has a ring to it that people understand. And this is another example, like in today's world, our teachers union at the school, we used to be able to put flyers in mailboxes among our teacher friends and the whole staff anytime there was political campaigns or things that, of importance. It was negotiated, and this is a goal of the unions, to negotiate that no one can use the mailboxes except administration and union. And then the union puts the mailboxes full of vote for him, vote for this person, vote for that person.
Oh, yes.
And there is, they tell you, give you a checklist and inundate you around political time. There is no option for anybody else to put anything into the mail, and they got that in the contract, and that's a top priority of the unions across the country. So communication being stifled, I think, is a method that has...
What happened to the First Amendment? I mean,
if it's in the contract, and if it's a contract item... you don't have any First Amendment.
Someone needs to challenge that in court.
Mm-hmm. But I'm just letting you know what's happening. And so this seems to, he had to sneak his information and merchandise to the people. See, but they're powerful, have the money, have the lawyers, and so the independent teachers, if you want to take them on, you will get yourself in a lawsuit, and so it's really...
Well, that's a lawsuit you could win. It might cost you a bunch of money, but you could win that one, I'm sure, if it's the way you say it is.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, imagine, if you will, what's going to happen now. Wycliffe has done his work. He has his Lollards. Remember, they were called Lollards. They're scattered all over the country. They're promoting their Protestant kind of ideas. England is tipping back and forth politically between Protestantism and Catholicism, and everybody's watching to see which direction the country is going to go. And word gets out that Bibles are coming in English. Printed Bibles, not handwritten Bibles, but printed Bibles in English. What do you think was going to happen? What do you think would happen in that kind of a setting? Stop and think about it. A revolution, yeah. Okay. Well, the Protestants, what would they do if they heard something like that? Yeah, exactly. Every Protestant wants to get his hands on one of these because he believes, based on what they had been taught 100 years earlier by Wycliffe, that the Bible is going to support many of their views against what they call the abuses of the church. And what's the church going to say? The Roman Catholic Church at this point in time. What's their attitude going to be toward this? Stop it if you possibly can in any way. And so, waiting on the shores, in effect, when these Bibles arrived, were two groups fighting to get a hold of them. The church leaders were fighting to get them so they could destroy them, and the common people were fighting to get a hold of them so they could read them. That's basically what happened. One German scholar, and just to talk a little bit more about Tyndale, and we'll see all this play out here. One German scholar writing about the same time said of Tyndale that he was so skilled, and you asked a little bit about this, Joanne, he was so skilled in seven languages, namely Hebrew, Greek, Latin, Italian, Spanish, English, French, and French. By the way, you notice it doesn't mention German, although he must have spoke some German because he was, unless he spoke Latin to Martin Luther, I don't know, that whichever he spoke, you would suppose it was his native tongue. So clearly, I mean, this guy was gifted in languages. There's no other way to put that. Then he added that, quote, the English, in spite of the active opposition of the king, were so eager for the gospel as to affirm that they would buy a New Testament, even if they had to give 100,000 pieces of money for it. So you can see what kind of, I mean, you know, whereas we get all excited about who's going to win the Super Bowl, In those days, they got all excited about who was going to get a copy of the Bible and where it was coming from and who was responsible. And, you know, imagine what kind of an exciting world would that be if it was like that now? You know, whoo! Who's going to get to read the Bible? As soon as word got around that Tyndale's New Testament was available in England, everybody wanted it. The common people wanted it to read it, and the church authorities wanted it to destroy it. A whole system of covert distributors developed in England and were supplied, and of course, who would be those covert distributors, many of them? Well, yeah, but the Lollards. These would be the people who had, the whole program had been started by Wycliffe, remember? And he had this group of people out there teaching. I'm sure many of them said, yeah, man life, we'd, and they became secret distributors. So a whole system of covert distributors. Lorna, yeah, hold on just a second. Mike's coming.
When was it that Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church and shut down all the monasteries and all that? Was
in the 1530s.
So just shortly after this.
Very shortly after this.
And then he did break with the Catholic Church. He wasn't a staunch defender until his death.
No, he always, for his entire life, he claimed that he believed the Catholic Church. He didn't agree with their authority. He thought that his authority was more important in England than their authority, but he still claimed to be a Catholic.
But didn't he kill the monks in all those monasteries?
No, he just took away their wealth. Now, at least that's the way I understood it. He took away, closed down the monasteries and said, out, you know. You got this parasite on the society that's just, you know, eating up people's money and so forth and not really producing anything. And so he stopped them, you know. We saw that back up here, the dates exactly. In number four, but his desire to divorce Catherine of Aragon in order to produce a male heir to succeed him led to a break with Rome in 1533. As a result of that and other conflicts with Rome, he dissolved the English monasteries in 1536 and again in 1539. So,
and just doesn't sound like a loyal Catholic.
Well, I'm sure that his version of things was that, you know, he was just trying to do what was necessary to preserve the monarchy. Go ahead, Brian.
Do you think the Roman Church of that day had paper-sniffing dogs to be able to detect the odor of fresh mint paper? I mean, they have to put it in coffee grounds when they brought it into London? I mean, how'd they do that?
Well, coffee grounds would probably work pretty well. No, they didn't have those kinds of...
Right, but they were doing that. I mean, the Bible was the narcotic of their day.
Yeah. Yeah, and they smuggled it, you can be sure. An English merchant by the name, and this is a very colorful story that I like, an English merchant by the name of Packington worked at Antwerp in Belgium and was a friend of both the Catholic Bishop Tunstall in London and of Tyndale. So imagine, here's this guy, he's great buddies with this Protestant reformer who's living in Belgium at this point in time, and he's also a great buddy with the chief Catholic authority in all of England. So the bishop contacted Packington and asked him to buy all the copies of the English Bible that he could possibly find before they reached England. See? Just get a hold of those things and buy them for me before they ever leave the continent. That way we won't have to worry about them over here in England. Once they get in England, they just sort of melt into the woodwork. You can't find them. So the bishop assured Packington, that he would pay whatever price to get them. He intended to burn them publicly at St. Paul's Cross in London, and that's in fact what he did. So Packington approached Tyndale, explained the situation, offered Tyndale a high price for his product. Tyndale produced them for Packington, who in turn gave them to the Bishop of London. The bishop had the books, Packington his thanks, and Tyndale had the money. So now he could... And, of course, he charged him a big price, and now he can print a whole lot more. So it's interesting. In fact, I looked for the quotation, but I couldn't find it. There's supposedly a quotation made by Tyndale that he said, they asked him, where do you get the money to print all these things. He says, well, my biggest contributor is the chief bishop of London. Anyway, you wonder, some of these stories are so good, you wonder how much if they get, they're apocryphal. But anyway, apparently this part at least is true. So going back to those first two editions from Tyndale, just since we are talking about how we got our English Bible, only a very few copies remain. Only 31 pages of the quarto edition, that was the minimized version without the notes and everything that he started out with. I mean, that he had to produce, what he produced after they stopped him making the one he wanted to make. Only 31 pages of that edition, of a single copy, do we know that are in existence today. Of the octavo edition, one copy is completely perfect except for a missing title page. And another copy, and by the way, some of you may have heard for many, many years that single copy was kept in this special Baptist mission college down in Bristol. And they had it in a kind of museum, and people would go there just to see it. Well, recently, the Baptist College got in financial straits, and they put it up for sale. There was a huge, auction over it. I think the British Museum ended up with it. They paid a high price. So what used to be in the Baptist Mission College in Bristol is now, I believe, in the British Museum, that one nearly perfect copy of Tyndale's work. That was the octavo edition. And another copy, very imperfect, is in the Library of St. Paul's in London, which has a lot of problems. So of some 18,000 copies printed between 1525 and 1528, those bits, the one in St. Paul's and the 31 pages elsewhere, and the one full copy, are all that we know that remain of Tyndale's original work. Isn't that incredible? 18,000 copies. Now, it's possible that someone's got one stored somewhere in his attic, that he got from his great-great-great-grandmother somewhere. It could happen. We don't know. But what we know, there are these three pieces. One is only 31 pages. One is in pretty bad shape. And then there's this one that's nearly perfect that we have left of those original volumes done by Tyndale. Because of his linguistic skills, Tyndale, of course, translated directly from the Greek to produce his New Testament. Remember that Wycliffe's Bible earlier had been translated out of what language? Latin, from the Latin Vulgate, Jerome's Vulgate into English. So around 1528, now this is 5 years now before Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church, feeling that he had done his job with the New Testament, Tyndale now turned to the Old Testament, and in the next 2 years translated the entire Pentateuch. In his Pentateuch, there were many marginal notes which were extremely controversial and inflammatory. One that I've mentioned, in which I should again look it up and get the exact wording for you. Although these things are not easy to find, you have to sort of look through until you find somebody who comments on it somewhere, because you don't have access to all those ancient documents. Or if you're like me, you don't have time to spend your days in the London Library or something. But anyway, one of these notes supposedly, beside the story where it talks about Aaron's calf and, Moses being up on the mountain, you remember there in Exodus 32 to 34, one note that Tyndale put in there beside that was, "Yea, but the Pope's bull slayeth more than Aaron's calf." And so you could imagine, how that ingratiated himself to the Catholic people reading his New Testament or his Old Testament. So in this time, he did the Pentateuch with a lot of inflammatory notes. In 1531, this would be 2 years now before Henry VIII broke from England, broke from the Catholic Church, he actually produced a translation of the small book of Jonah. Don't ask me why he did that. So he's done the Pentateuch and Jonah. Before going on with his translation of other portions of the Old Testament, he decides to go back and revise what he had done with the Pentateuch and also revising his New Testament again. So he came out with several versions of his New Testament and revised his Pentateuch at least twice. Tyndale had enjoyed a fairly safe time working at the English House in Antwerp, and of course that was in Belgium. He worked among a number of merchant friends, but his enemies in England were not quiet. They decided to send an Englishman by the name of Henry Phillips, a staunch Roman Catholic, to see if he could discover Tyndale's whereabouts. In May of 1535, after pretending friendship with Tyndale, he betrayed him into the hands of officers of Emperor Charles V, who seized him and carried him off, imprisoning him in Vilvoorde Castle near Brussels. Now remember, stop and think about this for a minute. Germany at this point in time was basically Protestant. Holland was pretty much Protestant. Brussels and France were basically Catholic. Why do you suppose he's hiding in a Catholic country in the process of producing an English translation for England? And just a thought. Why do you suppose he's hiding in a Catholic country? Yeah.
Hiding underneath their noses. They're probably looking at long distances, yeah, not expecting him to be right around the corner. So I think if they're looking far side, they're not looking right around the corner.
Yeah. I think that's probably, although I don't have the, official word, I don't know what his thoughts were, but apparently that was the situation. He thought that, he could hide under the nose and they wouldn't realize what he was doing or where he was working. Of course, he was, most of the time, spending his time with his books, he wasn't running around the public squares. Well, anyway, so he's arrested. And of course, if you've got a Catholic country, it's not hard if you're discovered for to stir up the authorities to arrest you. So, but during his imprisonment, apparently he was allowed access to at least some of his materials, and apparently he did another edition of his New Testament, and he may also have translated from Joshua through 2 Chronicles. Notice I said he may also have. The reason I say that is because he never got a chance to print it. And you'll see what happened here in a moment. Though he never had a chance to publish it. His friend John Rogers was left with that task. On October 6th of 1536, Tyndale was taken to trial, proved to be a heretic, and condemned to death. He was tied to a stake, strangled, and burned, with these words being his final message: "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." Now, the interesting thing is, the King of England apparently had nothing to do with his death. His death was the result of the Catholics in Belgium. But his message about the King of England was still appropriate, because he really shouldn't have been in Brussels at all. He should have been over back in England, doing his printing, his translating, his printing in England, but he couldn't do that because of what? Because of the king that was there. So his message was still appropriate, and believe it or not, it's going to be fulfilled, as we'll see in a moment. Tyndale's work had enormous and far-reaching consequences. His simple and precise language was exemplary. His scholarship was excellent. 90% of Tyndale's work was preserved in the King James Version. His translation became so popular that it set a standard for the English language for hundreds of years to come. 1 year after Tyndale's death in 1537, Henry VIII allowed the English Bible to be distributed in his kingdom. I mean, that's a sad commentary, isn't it? 1 year, if he had survived one more year, he could have gone home and maybe worked many more years. I mean, he died at, 50-something? He died as a young man, basically. And he could have continued it. But 1 year after his death, the English Bible was allowed to be distributed. Although Tyndale was gone, the influence of his work was certainly not. A close friend by the name of Miles Coverdale, who lived from 1488 to 1568, a former Augustinian friar, became a friend of Tyndall and a reformer on the continent. In 1535, he produced a translation based on the Vulgate, Luther, and Tyndall. So you see, now other people are borrowing stuff from Tyndall, even when Tyndall's still alive. They're taking bits and pieces from other people. They're taking some of Luther's stuff and translating it out of the German, and what they can't get from Tyndall or Luther, they're getting from the Latin Vulgate, and they're competing with Tyndall to produce an English translation. 2 years later, John Rogers, remember this was Tyndall's friend, and so in other words, 1 year after Tyndall's death, John Rogers, under the pseudonym of Thomas Matthew, published the Matthew's Bible, based on Tyndall and Coverdale and dedicated to Henry VIII. How do you like that? What a change, and if it had just come a year sooner. John Taverner again took up the work of John Rogers after John was martyred, so even though English Bibles were allowed to be distributed in England, it still wasn't safe to be known as a translator and printer. And and I need to look up more about the details of his death, but apparently he was recognized for what he had done, and so he too was martyred by Mary Tudor, and produced a version of the Matthew's Bible in 1539, which was the first one to be actually printed in England. Finally, Thomas Cromwell was able to produce the Great Bible, printed in England in 1539. It was essentially the same as the Coverdale Bible, but it is sometimes called the Cranmer Bible because Cranmer himself wrote the preface. So, what have we seen? What's going on here? Well, we have now brought the English Bible, the story of the English Bible anyway, up to the days of the King James. And what has happened is, the Reformation theologians are translating and putting Reformation notes in their Bibles. The Catholics are producing their versions, and I haven't talked about those yet, but they're putting their notes in the margins. And so you got dueling, battling Bibles. And what do you do in a situation like that? Well, some people, I guess with cooler heads, I hope so, decided that the solution should be that people should actually come together and try to produce a translation that was jointly agreed upon and which would have no marginal notes. And that's what happened when we got the King James. I mean, that's what's going to happen when we get the King James Version. But the Catholics didn't wait for the King James Version. What did they do before the King James came out? Again, we'll talk about this next time, but some of you know, I'm sure. What did the Catholics do before the King James? They did a very poor, very rigid, almost interlinear kind of translation, which came to be known as the Rems Due. And that was from Latin into, in fact, I don't know whether they consulted the Greek, I'll have to check that, or not, but they basically translated from, with Catholic ideas and so forth, into the English, but their many of the English words even that they used are really just Latin words sort of changed into English, and it's very hard to read if you read the original Rems Due. Rems being the New Testament translator, and Due being the Old Testament translator. And it came out several years before the King James. So I'm going to stop there, even though we're a little bit short on time. Next time, it's hard for me to judge in these things how much material we can cover in one time period. Does anybody have any questions about where we've come so far? Of course, the big question is, I'm going to try to ask Jim to bring some samples of some of these early English translations next time when we talk about it. Yes, Joanne.
Well, it seems like the pattern is, if you're doing anything for God, Satan actually pursues you. Packs of people pursue you wherever you go.
Yeah. I mean, you know, these people were saints, basically, and boy, the devil was after them. I mean, he realized that he was losing big time when the, if these people got away with their work. Yeah, Gordon.
Since we have some time, can you maybe give the big picture of where we've come so far from the first of these sessions to here?
Yeah, let's do that. That's a great idea. What we've covered so far is this. The original Bible was written on, probably on parchment, maybe on papyrus, in three languages. Hebrew, most of the Old Testament, a small portion of the Old Testament written in Aramaic, that would be the portion, some portions of Ezra, some portions of Daniel, and the apocryphal, well, we won't talk about the apocryphal stuff, but so Ezra and Daniel, I can't remember whether there's any Aramaic in Nehemiah. There might be a little bit of Aramaic in Nehemiah as well. And these, all of the original copies of every part, of course, the New Testament was written in Greek. None of those original documents are still available. I want that to be very clear. We do not have anywhere a single part of a page even of the original thing written by the original author. The closest we come to having something that was, you know, close to what the original author wrote was a small piece out of the Gospel of John. That's John 18 on one side, and I forgotten what's on the other side. It's written on both sides, a portion of John 18, that was written probably no more than 25 or 30 years, which was copied no more than 25, 30 years after John wrote it. So that's as close as we get of anything. It was written down in Egypt. It was copied, at least it was found down in Egypt. So that's the closest we get. So that means then that several things have happened between those originals and where we are now. The first thing that happened is that lots of copies were made. And those copies were all made by hand. No Xerox machines, no computers to make sure that if you make a mistake, you can go back and correct it and make another copy. Nothing like that. These copies, all these original copies, were made by hand. And there were various ways in which errors crept in because of that. Sometimes when they wanted to produce a lot of copies, someone would stand up in front and slowly read three or four words, and he would stop, well, for those words to be copied down, and read some more words for them to be copied down, and so forth. And a group of people would be sitting down at their desks, sort of, and copying down what they heard. So you can guess that certain kinds of errors crept in because one word sounds like another word. And so a person would write the wrong word, but a word that sounds the same as another word, which was the one that was intended. So those kind of errors crept in. Other kinds of errors crept in because of visual mistakes. You can be reading, and all of us have done this, I'm sure. You can be reading along in a line, your eyes are distracted for a moment, you come back and you pick up the word, maybe you ended with the word again, let's say. And you come back to the page and you see the word again and you carry on, but it actually turns out that again was three lines down. Or something like that. You know what I'm talking about here. And there are technical names for these kinds of errors that crept into the text because of copying. Well, all of that was going on with the Old Testament for hundreds of years until the times of Jesus. About 200 years, maybe as much as 250 years before Christ, more and more Jews were being scattered into what came to be called the diaspora, scattered around to other nations. And in these other nations, they were losing their Hebrew. They no longer spoke Hebrew. Few of them could read Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic if they lived in Palestine, but these people now were primarily living and working in Greek, so they hardly even spoke Aramaic. So demand came for a Bible to be translated into Greek. It was the lingua franca of those days. Remember, we're now talking about the days after Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great's one great purpose was to turn the whole world into a big version of Greece. You know, he wanted everybody to be Greek and learn Greek customs, Greek culture, Greek language, and everything. And there's a very interesting pseudepigraphical book about what happened there. We don't know for sure. One story is that Ptolemy, one of the leaders of, you know, one of the kings of Egypt, wanted to have a copy of every important book, or maybe even every book that had been written so far. He wanted a copy of it in his library at Alexandria. The Alexandrian library was very, very famous in ancient times. And so the word, this story says, whether it's true or not, I don't know for sure. Nobody knows for sure. The story has it that he contacted some Jewish people who lived in Alexandria, said, please, can you find a group of scholars for me who will come and translate your Bible, which is obviously a very important piece of literary work, that will translate your Bible for me in a language that I can read, into Greek. And so they sent for these scholars to come. Some people say 70 came, some people say 72 came. And supposedly they came down to Egypt. They were given, they were put into groups of two. So there were 35 or 36 of these groups. They were given copies of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, as we would call it now, put into individual, some versions of the story say they were put into caves. Other versions say they were put into cells, into small rooms. Two people working together. They were given 70 days, and at the end of 70 days, they came out, and all 35 groups, a total of 70 people, had come up with 35 different translations, all of which agreed exactly, and that's proof that this was an inspired translation from the original languages into Greek. Now, obviously, you recognize that this is either really miraculous, or the story isn't completely true. Others say that such a thing never happened at all, that there never was a Hebrew Bible that got translated into Greek and put into the library at Alexandria, but rather a group of Jews down in Alexandria, a large group of Jews in Alexandria, said, hey, we want the Bible that we can read in our language, and they just arranged for it to be done, maybe with a group of scholars from Palestine, whatever. But it was translated in Alexandria from Hebrew and Aramaic into Greek for the first time. That translation came to be known as the Septuagint, the Greek word for 70, because of the 70 scholars, the 70 days, whatever. So that was the Bible spoken by, used by most of the Jewish people. Now hear me carefully here. Used by the majority of Jewish people in the days of Jesus. What am I saying by that? I'm saying that most of the Jews in those days no longer lived in Palestine. Most of them lived in Egypt, in Europe, in Asia Minor, over into Iran. Well, it used to be Babylon, Persia, all those kinds of places. Most of the Jews lived outside of Palestine. And for those people, they welcomed this Greek version. It was their Bible. And of course, if they wanted a copy, they would have to make it by hand. These were all handmade copies. So that was the popular Bible in Jesus' day. Among Jews, that would be primarily outside of Palestine. In Palestine, of course, the Pharisees are standing tall and the scribes are standing tall, and they're demanding that everything has to be done in a Jewish way. We're not going to accept these Greek translations. The Bible that counts is the Hebrew and the Aramaic of the Old Testament, our Bible, our Old Testament. And so Jesus comes, he lives, he dies, and so forth. And as Christianity starts spreading through the world, a great battle arose. And that battle was between the Christians who said their New Testament, which was just in the process of being written, was actually the fulfillment of this Jewish Old Testament, as they saw it, and that these two books belong together, forming a whole Bible, And they claim, therefore, the Septuagint in Greek as the Christian Bible, as their Christian Old Testament. And they put it together with their New Testament, and they claim that now was the Bible. The Jews, of course, didn't want to have anything to do, the ones who remained Jewish, didn't want to have anything to do with the New Testament. They wanted to claim, because the majority of them, remember, lived outside of Palestine, they wanted to claim the Greek Old Testament, which they had arranged for the translation of. They wanted to claim it as their Bible in Greek. And there were a couple hundred years when there was almost knockdown, drag out fights between Jews and Christians about who would be the owners of the Greek Old Testament Septuagint. Well, the final end of that story came as a result of two factors. Of course, one major factor is the fact that the Jewish nation was wiped out because of the rebellion and so forth in the year AD 70, and Jerusalem was destroyed and so forth, and the Jews were taken off into captivity. And so they sort of were a headless group at this point in time. They had no Jerusalem to turn to. They had no Palestine to look to. They were sort of homeless people, if you will, scattered around through the world. And there was no evangelism per se among them. They felt very strongly about their Bible, and they turned to their Bible because that was the only thing they had to still hold on to that could sort of, be the core of their reason, if you will, for their existence. But the Christian church was growing just by leaps and bounds. Already in Paul's day, they were saying, you've turned the world upside down. And so very quickly, Christians outnumbered Jews, and finally the Jews said, okay, forget it. Take your Greek New Testament. We don't care. Our Bible is the Hebrew and the Aramaic of the Old Testament. You can do what you like with the Greek. We're going to stick with our Hebrew and Aramaic. And they just gave up on that fight. Well, in the process of all that, along the way, for whatever reasons, Christians added a number of apocryphal books to their Old Testament. And so the Christian Old Testament now included the Apocrypha as we now know it. And then basically what happened then was the next important thing that came along was Origen. O-R-I-G-E-N. And Origen realized that as he was a great scholar, he came from Alexandria, traveled to Palestine, lived in Palestine, really studied Hebrew and Aramaic very carefully, and realized that we got a problem here. A lot of people are making copies of these things, and a lot of mistakes have come into the text. And by this time, a couple of other people had translated the Bible and made other translations, Symmachus and, what's the other guy's name? Anyway, a couple of other translators had come along and made complete Old Testaments. And so Origen decided that he would make as his life duty the comparison of everything that had been produced so far and try to make an improvement, original version of the Old Testament, of the Septuagint. And so in his original thing, he showed the Hebrew Bible. Well, I should do it this way for your benefit. The Hebrew was first, and then the Septuagint, as he had it, I think, was next. And then some of these other translators. And the fifth column was Origen's best guess of what the very best possible Greek translation of the Hebrew. And he put little marks in there and all the way down through it, showing why he chose the words that he did. And he showed why this translation differs from that translation. All of that was carefully worked into this. And he did something like 12,000 pages of this material. An incredible life work trying to go through the whole Bible and produce this comparison, big, wide. And unfortunately for us, that whole work got burned when the Muslims came rampaging through the Middle East when they took over in those days. Fortunately for us, before that happened, Should have told me you were going to ask me this question. Anyway, a group from the East realized that this was a really valuable resource, and they came and copied major portions of it and putting it in their language, but copying what Origen had done, and down to this was a Aramaic. This is Aramaic that they did. I'm sorry. Armenia. No? Syriac. But that's, okay. Syriac, it's Syriac. It's a language that's very close to Hebrew and Aramaic, and so it was easy for them to put that more or less in their language. And so we have those, and they tried to copy more or less even many of Origen's markings, so we have those. But we don't have Origen's original work. Well, what happened as a result of that is people who were serious about the Bible said, oh, if we take Origen's fifth column, if we take Origen's fifth column over here, we have a better version of the Old Testament than any that's been available to us before. Now, we appreciate all his work, but we don't have time to do all the Hebrew and the Symmachus and all those other stuff down here. Let's just take this fifth column and let's reproduce that. So very quickly, Origen's fifth column came to be referred to as the Greek Bible. So now we have difficulty. When we start going back, it's hard to know whether the Greek we're encountering, if we find an old document, is this from Origen's work or is this prior to Origen's work? It's very difficult to know. But Origen's fifth column became the sort of standard Greek Bible of those days. And the next thing that happened about 100 years after Origen was, of course, Jerome. And Jerome was a good friend of one of the emperors in Rome. After Christianity had been declared to be the official religion of the empire, and this guy said to Jerome, hey, there's a lot of people around who are sort of making, you know, their own translations of this, that, and the other. We need an official translation of the Bible. And so he asked Jerome to do that. Jerome started off by doing stuff in Greek and so forth that he was already fairly familiar with, did the New Testament. But when he came to the Old Testament, he started to have doubts. He said, you know, I need to go back and look at the original. So he moved to Palestine and basically spent the rest of his life in Palestine, died in Palestine. He learned Hebrew, studied with Hebrew scholars, and decided that he needed to do his Vulgate, his Latin translation, directly from the Hebrew. And he did a very good job, basically. His Latin is free-flowing. It's easily read. I'm not a Latin reader myself, but what the scholars say about it is it's a very nice translation. And that became, by declaration and by practice, in over the next 100 years or so, became the default edition of the Bible used by the Catholic Church. It wasn't, however, until 1546, I think, the Council of Trent, that when after Luther and Tyndale and others had challenged the Catholic Church about their use of this Latin, that they came out and officially declared, this Latin Bible is the official Word of God. You know, you can do what you like with the original languages, but this Latin is God's Word according to the Catholic Church. So then we basically drop into the Dark Ages. And bits and pieces of things happened here and there around the world. Translations were made into Ethiopian language. Translations were made into remote languages, and some in England, even, believe it or not. Other parts up in Scandinavia, over into Russia and so forth. People here and there, we talked a little bit, we had one session about this. pieces of scripture here and there, but basically the central part of the Mediterranean world was called the civilized world in those days. The Latin Vulgate was the Bible. Then we come up to the time when we have Wycliffe, we have Luther, we have Tyndale that we've been talking about recently. Wycliffe was the morning star of the Reformation. He was sort of introduced to his material by Huss and Jerome. Yes, Brian, you got only got a minute or two left.
Did Jerome do his work after Origen or before Origen?
100 years after.
Okay.
Yeah. He used Origen, I'm sure. Yes, Don.
Because the Jewish people had been scattered so far and in so many different places, they had forgotten their Hebrew.
Yeah.
And this was one of the things that brought on the Septuagint.
Yeah, exactly. No, you're exactly right. Yeah. So Wycliffe, of course, we studied him. He was a scholar. He was in Oxford. He had he was head of one of the colleges in Oxford. So he was a very well recognized scholar. And he began taking on the abuses of the Catholic Church and writing tracts against them and so forth. And of course, the Catholics accused him, began to accuse him. And finally, toward the end of his life, Wycliffe says, I can see that the way to deal with this Catholic menace is to translate the Bible into the English language. And so he set about doing that. His translation was pretty good, but he had two friends that he worked with who, after he died, polished it up, made it a lot better. And so Wycliffe's translation, as improved by his friends, was the English Bible for 150 years, maybe, until the days of Tyndale and Luther, which is where we are now in our story. Okay, are there any other questions about that? That's a off the top of my head summary what we've covered so far.
Well done.
Thank you. Let's pray. Our kind and loving Father, it's good to see how you have worked in the past in blessing us and making it possible for us to stand here and to sit here and read your word as close as possible to the original intent in our language in 2008. Help us to treasure it more because of what we have learned is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all for coming.